From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and the people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the state of Texas ecology. Where are the trouble spots for nature across the state, and what can we do about it?
Do they buy wind energy, or do they buy something that's fossil fuel-based, or where do they live? I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that folks can engage in protecting the environment and you know, handing something on to their children and grandchildren that's better.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas coal mining, the spread of fire ants, the growth of light pollution, the shrinking migration patterns of monarch butterflies, the reduction of hill country springs, and the sprawl of cities and colonias in Texas. They all add up to a massive environmental challenge for the Lone Star State, and they are included in the book, The Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People. The book includes over 100 maps and charts that illustrate the complex and abstract, the sinking of Houston, toxic chemical air emissions across the state, tracking highway billboards, and more are laid out. The data-driven exploration of Texas environmental issues also makes it clear that there are many, many challenges for the state. David Todd is the co-author of the Texas Landscape Project. He is also the founder and coordinator for the Conservation History Association of Texas.
Texas is growing by leaps and bounds, both its population and its industry. And so as people make a home here and make industry and agricultural efforts here, it's bumping aside a lot of the natural ecosystems and wildlife here. And so while there's progress for people, I think that there's a cost to the natural world that we need to keep in mind as we develop the state.
You look at Texas land protection. We know that there's not a whole lot of federal land in the state, and that's generally across the nation where you see a lot of land protection happening. And there's not a lot of state land protection happening. So most land protection that is happening in the state is done either through privately or through hyper-local municipal efforts.
I think that's absolutely true. It's a really interesting story that I think goes back, over 170 years. And part of the reason behind the atlas is to try to give some context and background to some of these conservation stories, whether it's land or water or wildlife. And, you know, when Texas came into the Union, it had, I think it was over 225 million acres of publicly held land. And, at the present time, we've got about 3% of the state held by the government, whether it's local, state, or federal agencies. And so that's a real dilemma when you see that we've got a lot of folks that are developing those privately held portions of the state. And fortunately, though, I think that we're seeing some really interesting trends. And, you know, as you pointed out, a lot of the efforts are local, and I think some of the best ones are in your part of the state, which I guess we might call Central Texas and San Antonio. One of the examples that comes to mind is Government Canyon State Natural Area, which I think is just the poster child for the kind of collaboration that we'll need to protect significant parts of the land base of Texas. You know, you've got this very large parcel of land at Government Canyon that involved efforts from Texas Parks and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Trust for Public Land and the San Antonio Water System and Edwards Aquifer Authority. And so that kind of teamwork really made a huge impact in what was a very difficult project.
And taxpayers.
You know, a lot of this, I think that over $300 million has been raised by the San Antonio area through bonds and sales tax to protect over 100,000 acres of land in the Edwards Aquifer. So, you know, I think a lot of Texans are really stepping up and emptying their wallet to do really good conservation efforts.
But as I look at the map, you can see that it's piecemeal, very heavy protection as far as, you know, there is obvious, there's evidence of land protection going on in San Antonio, mainly to the northwest, and then up to Austin. It's you see a lot of indication that there's activity here. But otherwise, across the state, it's barren. Nothing happening in West Texas, hardly at all.
Well, I think you've got a good point. A lot of the conservation effort is happening in Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, the big metropolitan areas. But I think that there's some really interesting trends going on in some of the more far-flung parts of the state. You know, you mentioned the West and the South, and there are two things that are going on there that I think are really interesting and could be really productive for land protection in particular. And one of those is the wildlife tax exemption, which allows folks to get the same kind of tax treatment that they would if they were ranching or farming their land by just setting aside land for wildlife, whether it's deer or butterflies or birds, and doing some really proactive things to produce good habitat for those creatures. And then the other thing that comes to mind that I think, you know, may have some good impact on remote areas are these wildlife management associations. And those are cooperative groups. I think there are over 180 of them now in the state where landowners who are contiguous with one another can join together and manage their land as a pool. And so it really gives them a lot of leverage to protect land that may be in small individual parcels, but together, you know, can make a big impact for habitat.
So as you talk about land conservation in Texas, are you talking about trying to preserve original prairies? What is it you want to do?
You know, prairies that you mentioned is a great example. We have probably less than 0.3% of the tall grass prairies that were originally in Texas, and Texas was basically a grassland state. So that's really significant that there's been that much lost to grazing and to cultivation and to development. But there's some really interesting efforts there to replant prairies and to manage the land that was once in grassland in ways that, you know, whether you're using rotational grazing or fire or other tools to try and bring back some of these older prairies that may still be recoverable, salvageable.
What is the benefit of doing that, other than having nostalgia, like this is what Texas used to look like? What's the incentive to reclaim the land?
If you have these natural grasslands, for example, they capture a lot of runoff. So when we have what we call, I guess, rain bombs that we've been seeing in central Texas and down in Houston, where you get these intense rainstorms, maybe 10 inches in a day. If you've got a tall grass, bunch grass prairie, it captures an enormous amount of runoff before it can go into streams and flood people downstream. So that's significant. Another thing that an intact grassland can do is say you have one of these big rain events again, it can filter out a lot of the nutrients and sediments that might otherwise go into our drinking water supplies. So there's some things that really directly benefit people, aside from all the critters that might rely on a prairie, for example.
I've heard that if you do that type of restoration to your ranch, you will see the return of a quail.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think there are a lot of hunters and sportsmen out there who, have missed the quail that we often saw, the bobwhite quail, down in South Texas and other parts of the state when a lot of these improved grasses were brought in for grazing. When the bunch grasses are brought back, it allows the paths through the grass that bobwhite quail can use to move around. And so, they're seeing huge recoveries with those techniques.
So quail is another one of these iconic animals of Texas, which we've seen almost become more and more harder to find. And also another iconic creature of Texas, which is, struggling to survive, is the bighorn sheep.
Exactly. And I think that's a really encouraging story that involved cooperation between a lot of Western states and private landowners and hunters to bring back this this magnificent animal that used to be seen out in the Davis Mountains in the Trans-Pecos, and was really shot out over, maybe 100 years, and finally disappeared in the early 60s. But then in the years since then, numerous efforts have been made to capture these sheep where they still persist out in Nevada and California and New Mexico and other parts of the West, and bring them into Texas, breed them in captive pens, and then re-release them in a number of protected, both public and private lands out in the Big Bend area, and then down into Mexico as well. And we're just seeing incredible recovery of that animal.
But just as our native grasses are trying to compete against invasive species, so is the bighorn sheep. There are African sheep that have escaped from exotic ranches that have taken to the same areas and are out competing the bighorn.
That's absolutely true. I think that there's a problem we bump into again and again across the country. People are saying now that exotics are, whether it's an exotic plant like a ligustrum or a nandina, or it's a an exotic animal like an owdad, one of these African sheep, they're incredibly prolific and they're wonderful competitors. They're really vital animals and plants, and they've really done a number, you might say, on a lot of the native ecosystems that we have here in Texas.
You point out in your book, The Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People, that the border wall is a concern. There already is a border wall built in parts of the Texas-Mexico border, and that is presenting issues for wildlife.
Well, that's true. It's one of these interesting situations where you have two sort of competing priorities for the government. On the one hand, the federal government and its state partners have invested hundreds of millions of dollars over a generation in protecting key habitat along the Low Rio Grande Valley, and then in recent years there's been concern about violence and drug trafficking and immigration across that same border, and so the government is torn between protecting the animals and plants that are in that area, and also trying to make the border secure. And, this has sort of played out with having, fence lines and pretty imposing border walls that have gone through a number of the National Wildlife Refuges down in the lower Rio Grande Valley, as well as out in California, New Mexico, and Arizona. So it's a real dilemma, and, there's no easy answer because there are these sort of competing camps, concerned about the same part of the country.
Well, we've had the border wall down in the Rio Grande Valley for a while now. It's got to be there for at least 5 years. So we can stop speculating about what impact it's going to have on the ocelot and other creatures of concern. So what is the impact? What do we know?
A lot of times, I think, natural systems respond over decades or generations, while our economic cycles go in terms of fiscal quarters, or our elections go in terms of 2 years or 4 years, and so oftentimes we don't get the kind of response from our understanding of the natural world in time to make intelligent decisions for the kind of financial cycles or election cycles that we might have. I'm not sure if the jury is really in yet on what the impact is on these creatures along the lower Rio Grande Valley.
So is the jury also still out on the impact of wind power? As Texas grows, we need more energy, and we are turning to renewables, and wind is plentiful in Texas. We're seeing places, particularly in the Panhandle, those turbines are everywhere. What is the impact on wildlife?
Particularly down in South Texas, a lot of these wind turbines have been built in areas that for eons have been the main track for migratory birds. And so as these birds come up out of Latin America and head north, or you know, when they're making their return travel, they run through the same area that these 80-meter tall turbines have been built. And some people call these bird Cuisinarts because you know, birds can hit them, as can bats, and they're just obliterated. And they're trying remedies for, you know, sighting them in areas where you know, some of the migrations aren't quite as strong. I know that's been a solution out in California. And they're also trying measures where they can turn off a wind turbine during peak migratory times. But it's just a, you know, real conflict, and I'm not sure that there's an easy answer to that.
Well, it's not just birds, but, you know, there are actually rare and endangered cacti in South Texas, and when someone decides they're going to put up a bunch of these windmills, that they do root plowing all over a lot of acreage, and they're destroying habitat.
That's been a problem for many years. I'm glad you pointed that out. There, you know, while there's a lot of very strong endangered species protection for animals, the protections for plants have never been quite as strong. And so, you know, a lot of this is on private land. The data is not good, and unfortunately, the protections just aren't as strong.
This is Texas Matters. We're speaking with David Todd, co-author of the Texas Landscape Project. One thing you point out that is of interest is billboards. You know, that is something that people don't normally think about when we're talking about the landscape of Texas and what needs to be protected. And billboards is kind of that eye trash on the side of the road that, you know, it doesn't really seem to benefit anyone except for the people who are selling the billboards and the advertisers.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of times environmental issues are seen as maybe involving sort of natural ecosystems or perhaps public health protections. But I think that some of the oldest concerns about the environment really go to aesthetic issues of how things look. And I think there is frustration that, you know, some people call the billboards a litter on a stick, that those sort of commercial messages are not really in keeping with the kind of bucolic views that we'd like to have of you know, our natural lands. You know, but they do make money for a number of people who erect these signs and who have the land where the signs are put and for the businesses that are advertised there. So it's again one of these sort of conflicts that I'm hoping the book sort of lays out, and folks can decide, you know, where they come down on you know, some of these dilemmas.
And you also write about how Houston at one time was overrun by billboards, but then they changed things. And what kind of policies did they adopt that began to take down billboards?
Well, that's you're absolutely right, and you know, there, while the federal government has the sort of veto control on all the federal highways where you see a lot of these billboards, that's under the Highway Beautification Act from 1965, and so that's been a, you know, a very long kind of regime. But in towns off these federal highways, the municipalities have a lot of say-so about where these billboards can be built, their size, how many they are, and whether they're built at all. And so I think there have been over 200 communities in Texas, including Houston, of course, that have invested in either banning new billboards or then investing in retiring old billboards by buying them out.
Or they can put up rules saying as the city grows or new highways are developed, and a billboard company wants to put up a billboard there, they say, if you put up a new billboard, then you got to take three or four down elsewhere.
Yeah, there are ways to mitigate it like that, and you can set up scenic routes. And you know,
but
as
you said, but just like
now,
you point out, you know, as Texas is a patchwork of municipalities trying to be progressive, it's working in Houston, it's not working in San Antonio, and people have got to wonder, you know, how can we become more aggressive in certain areas?
Well, you know, I'm hoping that people who you know, read this book, Texas Landscape Project, will start thinking about those things and try and figure out, are there places that they can take the initiative, whether it's, you know, the example you gave earlier with, you know, San Antonio investing so much in bonds and sales tax funds to protect land in Edwards Aquifer, or whether it's, you know, folks in Houston investing and taking down billboards that they don't approve of. I'm hoping that folks will realize that a lot of times the onus falls on individuals, on the grassroots, on local municipalities to take the initiative, and that they can't expect the state or the feds to manage all these things.
Here we are in the summertime, key vacation time. People head to the beach. What is the state of the beaches, the coastline in Texas, looking at it from a landscape project point of view?
Well, I think that there are a couple aspects. One is the quality of the water, and I think we're lucky in that some of the cleanest waters in the state are actually along the Gulf. It's unfortunate, but a lot of the streams and lakes have not really lived up to the promise of the Clean Water Act, which said that we would have fishable, swimmable waters that were, you know, safe for diving and swimming in over 30 years ago. That just hasn't happened. But fortunately, the Gulf remains to be a pretty safe place. And I guess the other aspect about the coast is, of course, we're already into hurricane season. And I think that's an area where I hope Texans start thinking about their safety and their neighbors' safety, because, you know, we are seeing a lot of erosion along the coast. We're seeing rising waters. Storms are getting more intense. And we've had examples such as Hurricane Ike and Hurricane Allison that have really wrecked terrible damage along the coast. And so I'm hoping that folks will, you know, look at some of these maps and read some of the discussions in the book and think about the trade-offs between enjoying the coast and putting yourself at risk by building a house there.
But like the reefs, the quality of Texas reefs, and we're hearing about reefs that are in trouble around the world. And Texas seems to have an abundance of artificial reefs. Is that filling the void?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because I think that Texas is fortunate to have something called the Flower Gardens and the Stetson Banks that are off the sort of northeastern Texas coast out in the Gulf. Those really are only natural reefs, but the Texas Parks and Wildlife has been very inventive about creating new artificial reefs where they've sunk old offshore oil rigs and old ships have been sunk offshore, and then concrete structures have been laid on the ocean floor, and that gives a place for young fish to be protected, and I think the theory is that you're increasing the fishery for years to come.
But there is this dead zone that pops up in the Gulf of Mexico every summer. What is causing that, and what is the state of it? And it seems to be growing each year.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the quotes that we have at the beginning of our book is drawn from John Muir, and basically he says that everything is connected to everything else. And, you know, when we see a dead zone where basically the oxygen is depleted and nothing can live in that part of the ocean, that can be traced back to agricultural processes and practices up in the Midwest by the kind of cultivation that folks do in Iowa or Illinois or a thousand miles away. So I think as this world gets smaller and smaller, I think we're realizing that things that we do upstream affect those folks that might be downstream, and that we really have to be conscious of the impacts that our lives may have on our neighbors.
As you put together the Texas Landscape Project, and you can tell just by listening to our conversation, as it just seems to meander all over the place because there's so many topics that you cover here, and we didn't even get to half of them. What was really the surprising thing for you?
Well, I guess there are a number of things. One is that a lot of these stories are so old. You know, they come up on whether it's your Facebook page or on the front page of the newspaper. But a lot of times they have very deep roots. And one thing that struck me recently was that American bison was declared the national mammal. And the story on that goes back, 130, 40 years to the bison being wiped out in the northern part of Texas up in the Panhandle, and then being saved by Charlie Goodnight, who was this famous Texas Ranger and cattle rancher, and then gradually being brought back to where now there are hundreds of thousands of bison. So, to really get a full picture of a lot of these natural resource and conservation issues, you've got to look back so far in history to really get the full idea of what's happened and what's been successful and what's failed and what's promising for the future.
Which of the many maps that are included in your book really tells the story of the state of Texas nature?
Well, that's interesting because I think it isn't so much the picture of nature, but maybe the picture of people. And that's part of the reason for the title, Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People, because they're sort of two sides of the same coin. We are part of nature, but we're also apart from nature. And so one of the maps that really struck me is the map of sprawl. And, if you look at it, much of the eastern half of the state has got some sort of sign of residential development. It's really striking, and I hope people might look at the book and they'll see for themselves. But that we are a poster child for the kind of low density development sprawl that has really limited a lot of the habitat in the state. And so I'm hoping that folks might look at that map and start to think about the decisions in their own life about where they live and how they live. Are they going to choose a house out on in the exurbs or in the suburbs? Or might they think about a more dense way of living closer to the core of the city? I mean, those kind of decisions can make a huge impact on the viability of natural systems in the state.
So is that the call to action that's included in your book, the Texas Landscape Project? People need to take a better look at their role in the overall landscape.
I hope so. I think that would be a wonderful thing if people came away not feeling, beleaguered and harassed by environmental concerns, but maybe empowered where they felt there are things that they can do, whether it's the kind of energy that they buy, do they buy wind energy or do they buy something that's fossil fuel-based, or where do they live, or, do they get involved in one of these big data efforts of reporting birds that they've seen or butterflies that they've tagged? I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that folks can engage in protecting the environment and handing something on to their children and grandchildren that's better.
David Todd is the co-author of the Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People. He is also the founder and coordinator for the Conservation History Association of Texas. The book is a data-driven exploration of environmental challenges to Texas. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.